So we were discussing last night how Yaakov Avinu went back after all of his family had already crossed the river Yabok, or the stream Yabok. So Yaakov went back to recover some pachim ketanim, small jars. And then the Torah gives us a very mysterious scene, the Avek Ish Imai, that there was a man that fought with him until Alos HaShachar, until the breaking of the dawn. Now, the nature of this man is not at all clear. On one hand, he's defined as an angel. He's defined as a man. Chazal have a mesorah that this mysterious entity is none other than the angel of Esav himself. It is the guardian angel of Esav. What is that concept? That every nation, really, so it's not so much every person, every nation, because Esav is the progenitor of a nation, has a certain angel in Shemayim that represents the spiritual fortune of that nation. And before Yaakov meets Esav in the flesh, he grapples with the spiritual force that Esav represents. And this is a struggle that goes on the entire night. And in the morning, Yaakov finally wins. And the angel says, I have to leave. And why does the angel have to leave? Because in the morning, the angels have to say Shira, songs of praise to God. But the angel blesses Yaakov that your name shall no longer be Yaakov, which means heel in the dirt, but it shall be Yisrael. Yisrael means he who has triumphed with God over adversity. Sarisa im Elokim. You have triumphed with God over adversity. And in the morning, what has happened is that although Yaakov was victorious, but Yaakov is left limping. Like Yaakov is left limping, his thigh was dislocated. And the Torah tells us, therefore, in commemoration of this event, the Jewish people do not eat the sciatic nerve, that's called the Gid HaNosheh, which is located over the area of the thigh that was dislocated. Now, a few different things here. What is the whole meaning of this particular story? So again, Rav Shimshon Frald Hirsch gives us, I'm sorry, it's not Rav Hirsch, it's Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch much earlier basically says that this is a foreshadowing of the thousands of years of gullus and persecution that the Jewish people shall undergo. That gullus will be a long, dark night. And during that night, there will be many, many times when the enemies that try to destroy us appear to be victorious, because at various points in the night, the angel of Esav was victorious over Yaakov. But the Torah is promising you that at the end of this long night, there will be a dawn, there will be a day. And when that day comes, the Jewish people will still survive. And the very forces that try to destroy the Jewish people will give the Jewish people a blessing and acknowledge that they are the people of God, right? So Yaakov is essentially experiencing the entire unfolding of the Jewish people, in which there will be gullus and persecution and darkness and defeat. But the end of that darkness, there will be a day and a morning. And in that morning, it's not simply the enemy will be vanquished. Rather, it'll be more than that. The very enemy that wanted to destroy you is going to give you a blessing, is going to acknowledge that Klal Yisrael has such an important role in the world. And that is the meaning of why you can't get a good sirloin steak in the world. Because basically the problem is this. Every time we don't eat the Gid HaNosheh, we are remembering the struggle of Jacob, of Yaakov, and the angel. Now, let me explain a little bit about the sirloin steak. That may have been a little obscure. The Gid HaNosheh is a nerve, okay? But it's a huge nerve. It's a nerve that basically penetrates the entire hindquarter of the animal. And theoretically, that nerve should be removed. In other words, when you're kosharing meat, after you slaughter the meat, there's a whole skill in removing, just like there are forbidden fats, which is called chalev. Some fat is permitted. That's the fat you'll see on your meat, but the chalev is removed by a butcher. So too, the Gid HaNosheh should be removed. The problem is that it's very, very difficult to remove the Gid HaNosheh because it's so big and it permeates. It has many branches, so to speak. So the common commercial practice in kosher slaughterhouses is that it is not worth the time and the money to remove the gid anasheh, so they simply sell the entire back half of an animal to non-kosher meat processing. So in kosher slaughter, typical kosher meat only comes from the front half of the animal. It does not come from the back half of the animal because it's difficult to remove the gid anasheh. Now, many very expensive cuts of meat actually come from the hindquarters. Sirloin steak comes from the hindquarters of animals. Filet mignon actually comes from the, fancy steak. I'm not such an expert either, but I know that that particular cut comes from the hindquarters. And as a result, typically kosher meat will not have those fancy quarters. However, number one, some restaurants do custom orders, meaning some very fancy restaurants will actually pay the butcher to do the gid anasheh, and they'll buy a limited number of hindquarters. And in some places, including Israel in some places, where there's a shortage of meat, so they go to the trouble of removing the gid anasheh. But in the United States, generally speaking, kosher slaughter does not do anything with the hindquarters of the animals. They sell it to a non-Jew because of the difficulty of the gid anasheh. Okay. But be it as it may, the basic message of the gid anasheh story is the reassurance to Am Yisrael that after the long darkness of Golos, there will be light and there will be a bracha. But what's significant is, and this is sobering, that when that day comes, we will still be around, but we will be limping, we will be hurt. Meaning, the message is, don't think it's going to have a totally happy ending. That by the time Mashiach comes, there's still going to be, there will have been a legacy of suffering. In other words, that's also the message, that we're alive, but we're limping around. Now, there's an interesting pasuk that the Rambam talks about halachically, and that is, it says, after the story, before he met Esav, the pasuk says, "Al kain lo yochlu bnei Yisrael es gid hanasheh, asher al kaf hayorech ad hayom hazeh." Therefore, the Jewish people are not allowed to eat or do not eat the gid hanasheh, the sciatic nerve, which is on the thigh, until this very day. By the way, what does that phrase mean, until this very day? What is this day that it's referring to? So some commentaries say this day refers to whatever day you're reading it. In other words, because the Torah is eternal, when I say until this very day, it means now, right? 1,000 years ago when they read it, it meant then. But it means it keeps on going, right? It keeps on changing. Therefore, you don't need to get anasheh until this very day. Ki naga, because this angel touched or smote the kaf, the thigh of the Yaakov, begid anasheh. Now the question is this: when did the Jewish people, or when did the descendants of Yaakov, stop eating the gid anasheh? So the Rambam actually says, interestingly enough, that Yaakov and his children were allowed to eat gid anasheh. The Al-Kain is referring to Matan Torah, meaning because of this event, because remember, when the Torah is written, right, the Torah is being written from the perspective of a Torah being given to Bnei Yisrael. So what it's saying is, because of this event, the Jewish people are commanded by God not to eat the gid anasheh. But the Rambam says that commandment was given at Matan Torah. In other words, you don't understand the verse that right after this event, God told Yaakov, you can't eat the gid anasheh. Rather, the Torah is recording why it later prohibited the gid anasheh because of this maisa, which means to say, in other words, if any of Yaakov's children or Yaakov himself wanted to eat the Gid Anasha, that would have been permitted. Okay. In fact, the Rambam lays down a general rule that's even true for circumcision, amazingly enough. Although it's absolutely clear that Bris Mila was given to Avram as a mitzvah. It's not like we don't circumcise now because it was a new mitzvah. We circumcise because it was given to Avram. But the Rambam actually says that had the mitzvah not been reiterated at Matan Torah, it would not have been binding on us. The Rambam says every single thing the Jewish people do is only because Hashem told Moshe at Har Sinai that we're supposed to do it. So until Har Sinai, we were doing it because we were the children of Avraham. But after Har Sinai, we did it because it was a mitzvah of the Torah. That's the Rambam's Yisod. The Rambam considered it to be, it's not so clear why it's that important, but the Rambam considered it to be theologically very significant that all obligation of the Jewish people to keep commandments come from the revelation at Mount Sinai. And even those commandments that we were keeping before Mount Sinai, we only have to continue to keep them because Hashem gave them at Har Sinai. But in the case of Gid Anasha, it's even more than that. It wasn't even given as a mitzvah until Har Sinai, and the Torah is just writing it in conjunction with the historical events which Gid Hanasha commemorates.
But don't we only know which commandments were the Noah commandments by the fact that they aren't repeated at Mount Sinai?
Yes, so that makes it the Noahide commandments. Yeah, that's correct.
But then aren't those commandments incumbent upon us too?
Actually not. That's an interesting point. For example, if I were to ask you, why are we not allowed to murder? The answer would be, it's not because it's one of the seven commandments of Noah and we're part of humanity. We're not allowed to murder only because God said at the Ten Commandments that the Jewish people are not allowed to murder. So the truth of the matter is, we don't have the Noahide laws. Now, it happens to be there is no Noahide law that doesn't have a parallel in the Torah's laws, but we are not obligated under the Noahide code. We are only obligated under the Sinaitic revelation. And the Rambam says even circumcision that explicitly was given to Avram as a commandment is a mitzvah upon us only because of Matan Torah. Bris Mila is repeated. Bris Mila is in fact repeated in Parshas Tazria, when a woman gives birth to a child. Pruervu is not repeated, but you have to understand the following. Even though Pruervu is not repeated, but by definition it was given us to our Sinai because that is when Moshe was told to write it down. So in a sense, when he's writing down what was given before, that is the revelation of God at Sinai, you see. So when I say Sinai, by the way, I don't mean specifically for the 40 days, because according to many opinions, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the Torah over a period of 40 years. But we do mean that was the divine revelation. So in a sense, every mitzvah in the Torah was given at Sinai because Hashem told Moshe to write it down. That's why Pruervu is an obligation on us. Okay. Now, the Gemara in Chulin discusses who was this mysterious man? Who did he look like? Right, the angel of Esav. Who did Yaakov think he was fighting? So according to one opinion, he looked like an armed robber. He looked like an axe murderer. Looked like a bad guy. Right, terrorist. So that's pretty obvious. Yaakov is fighting the bad guy. But according to another opinion in the Gemara, he looked like a Talmud Chacham with a white beard and very saintly, very pious. And it looked like Yaakov was being attacked by a righteous tzaddik. And the Gemara doesn't explain, like, what's the significance of the imagery. Like, you know, did he look like an axe murderer? Did he look like a righteous man? What exactly is going on? But some of the Bali Musar say very interesting thoughts. They actually say that Yaakov is grappling not so much with an external force, but Yaakov is grappling with the inner demons within his own personality. What do we mean by this? Yaakov is about to encounter Esav, And Yaakov is very fearful for his life, right? Yaakov is afraid that he might be destroyed. What does a tzaddik do? What should all of us do before we encounter a great, great danger? We do a cheshbon hanefesh. We look into our own lives. We look into whether we're worthy of God's protection. And if we have sins, if we have imperfections, we grapple with them and we try to fix them and we try to resolve them and we try to do tshuva. Seen in this way, Yaakov is wrestling with his own life. He's saying, am I deserving to defeat Esav? After all, I cheated Esav twice. I took his birthright. I took the brachos. Yes, I had reasons for doing so. Yes, that's what my mother told me to do. Yes, it seems to have been from Hashem. But were my motives pure? Perhaps I was acting out of selfishness, out of egotism. So in a sense, in a very metaphorical way, when you're grappling with that righteous Talmud Chacham, you're really fighting yourself. And Yaakov is struggling whether he is deserving of God's blessing. And it's very symbolic that the Torah emphasizes that he is all alone and nobody is with him. Because that's very important. When we have other people around, we kind of create defenses. We make up excuses, right? We don't really bare our souls. It's kind of in the darkness of the night, in the lonely moments, when a person is all alone, that they have to confront the inner reality. It's a very difficult process. Now, I know this sounds a bit of a psychological interpretation, but it is a pshat that is offered in terms of what the Torah is describing. And at the end of that Cheshbon HaNefesh, Yaakov's name is changed to Yisrael. But it's interesting. It is interesting that, right, many people have these name changes. Avram's name was changed to Avraham. Sarai's name was changed to Sarah. Yitzchak's name is not changed. But Yaakov's name is changed to Yisrael. But it's interesting that there's a difference between Avram's name change and Yaakov's name change. Avram's name change is permanent and irreversible. You are only allowed to call Avraham, Avraham. The Gemara in Brachos says, if you call him by his old name, Avram, without the hay, you are transgressing a commandment, because the Torah says, Hayashimcha Avraham, your name shall be Avraham. On the other hand, when it comes to Yaakov and Yisrael, We use both names, right? Plenty of people are called Yaakov. And the Torah itself goes back and forth. Sometimes it calls him Yaakov. Sometimes it calls him Yisrael. So what is the idea that Avraham's name is permanently changed, but Yaakov keeps both names? Right? So let's go back to Avram for a moment. Why was Avram's name changed? Because Avram is a contraction of Av Aram. Av, he was a spiritual patriarch in Syria, Haran, where he came from. That was the original name. His sphere of influence was in Aram. Avraham adds the acronym Av Hamon Goyim. He will be the father, spiritual father, to a multitude of nations, meaning Avraham will be a world figure, not necessarily in the sense of being famous, but in the sense that the whole idea of God in the world comes from Avraham. Right? Now, see how true this is. In fact, Christianity, Islam, are all breakaways from Judaism. And Avraham was the founder of the Jewish religion in the sense of teaching one God to the world. Right, that's why they call Christianity and Islam Abrahamitic faiths, if you ever see that expression. The faith of Abraham, it all comes from that. What about Eastern religions? Well, to some degree, Eastern religions are not monotheistic, so anyway, they're avodah zarah. But remember, we discussed that according to some interpretations, the children that he had from Keturah, he sent them to the East with gifts, and some interpret that to be the wisdom of the Orient. So in a spiritual sense, Avraham is the father of all humanity who seek God. And that's why we don't go backwards. We can't refer to Avraham as the patriarch of Syria. Avraham had a new mission, a greater mission. And the larger includes the smaller. What sense would it be to talk about him as the patriarch of Syria if in fact his influence is the whole world? But with Yaakov and Yisrael, even after the name change, Yaakov is still connected to Yaakov. Why is that so? What does Yaakov mean? Yaakov means heel. Heel. Right? The heel is the part of your body that's in the mud, in the dirt. So what happens is this. Yaakov is the name that is normally associated with struggle, with mud, with defeat, with galus, with persecution, but also with humility. Yisrael is the name that is associated with triumph and victory. And that's why you'll find in the Chumash, and pay attention to this as you read the Parshas, that whenever Yaakov is in a state of despondency or defeat, the name Yaakov is used. So for the 22 years that Yosef is separated from Yaakov, the name that is always used is Yaakov. As soon as he reunites with Yosef, Yisrael. But since the Jewish people will have times of going down and times of going up, Yisrael is our ultimate destiny. But Yaakov is still the name we have to have because much of our life is going to be Yaakov. But more than that, Yaakov is not only a term for defeat and galus, it is also a term for humility. And that's very significant. The ability of the Jew to be victorious is only because he's still connected to Yaakov, humility. Because when there is arrogance, Hashem is not with you. And therefore, the mila of the name Yisrael emanates from the name of Yaakov. You understand? In other words, it is the humility of Yaakov that enables the grandeur of Yisrael. Because without that humility, there could be no grandeur. And that's why both names are retained. But then I want to tell you a thought of Rav Kook, the great Rav Kook. Again, I could talk about Rav Kook quite a lot because no one else talks about him here. But Rav Kook, as you know, was the first chief rabbi, not of the State of Israel. There was no State of Israel. Rav Kook died in the 1930s. But it was called Palestine, essentially. And he was a great, great Gadol B'Torah, a very, very great Gadol B'Torah. In spite of what anybody else might tell you, and he was Masader Kedushin for Rebbe Yosef. I mean, Rebbe Yosef considered him to be a tzaddik and a goyin, and his Rebbe in many ways. And Rav Kook was unique, however, among Gedolim, because he was, of course, a Baki in Shas and Poskim, great Posek and a great Gadol, and an expert in both the revealed parts of the Torah and the hidden parts of the Torah. Rav Kook was also a great Makubal. At the same time, but he had a mystical vision in which he saw that even within secular movements, like Zionism and the like, he saw this as the striving of the neshama to become close to God. And even if it got perverted, in fact, he had a whole theory or thesis based on Kabbalah that sometimes, it's a very difficult idea, sometimes holy and elevated ideas can enter the world only, as they have to be, you might call it, a sheep in wolf's clothing. What do I mean? We have the other expression, right? A wolf in sheep's clothing is when something is bad, but it looks like it's good. Rav Kook said, in spiritual life, things sometimes work the other way. Things are good, but they have to be disguised as bad. Because the kochos of Tumah will not let Kedusha come in, unless somehow the kochos of Tumah can get fooled by the goodness coming under the radar. And therefore, Rav Kook explained, that is why the building up of the land of Israel had to come through secularists and even godless people to some degree. Because it was such a wholly elevated idea that the powers of Kedusha wouldn't let it come in unless it looked like it was treif. So it had to dress up in a treif way. But the panemius, the internal motivation, of even the agnostic Zionist. And they would deny it. But ultimately, it was the spirituality of their soul that was pushed. Again, this is a very, very controversial, difficult, subtle idea. But it comes up in other areas too, feminism. It comes up in all sorts of areas where there are many, many movements that are against Torah. Many movements that are against Torah. But they contain certain kernels of goodness that can be constructive and productive in certain ways if you know what to take and what to reject. And they enter the world in the guise of something bad, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to enter at all. This was Rav Kook's idea. So Rav Kook said the following. Rav Kook said that the role of religion and morality in the world, he says like this. First of all, he says like this. He says, the world needs Aesops. Why do we need Aesops? He says, Aesops serve a very important function in the world. Because if all you had, he said, was a world of tzaddikim. Tzaddikim, of course, they devote their lives to serving Hashem. But tzaddikim are inherently passive. By that I mean to say, the tzaddik is not going to build skyscrapers. The tzaddik is not going to drain the swamps. The tzaddik is not going to conquer disease. The tzaddik will be sitting and learning and serving God. So how are you going to have the infrastructure that the world needs to survive? So you need the Aesop-type personalities in the world, who build, who hunt, who create, who create the infrastructure, right? I mean, imagine this. I mean, if the Haredi world says to people, you shouldn't go to college, don't have secular studies, okay, all of those things. Learn is the most important thing. And that's a wonderful thing, and of course that's true. But the question is, so who's going to be your doctors when you get sick? You need, in a way, you need a world where not everybody is doing the ideal thing, because the ideal thing itself could not keep the world going. So yes, Limud HaTorah is the most important thing. But we couldn't have a world where every single person was learning Torah all the time. Now, some would argue with them. Some would say, well, if every Jew was learning Torah all the time, we wouldn't need doctors because there wouldn't be sickness. You know, there are different ways of looking at it. But Rav Kook was trying to explain that, in a sense, we need the kochos of Aesop in the world. But what's the problem? If Aesop is not restricted or limited by the powers of morality and religion, Aesop becomes evil and destructive. So the Aesops who go out and create, they have to be restrained in some way. So he says, this is Yaakov. Because if you remember, Yaakov was given the name Yaakov because when Aesop was trying to come out of the womb, Yaakov was holding on to Aesop's heel. So what do you do when you're holding on to a heel? You're pulling somebody back. So Yaakov represents the force of Torah in the world that tries to hold back the impulses within the humanity that seek to create and to build. In other words, like this. On one hand, we need people to create, to build, to innovate, to invent. But we need the Torah to kind of hold them back a little bit and say, Ad Kan. So when people talk about, let's clone human beings, or let's do genetic engineering, or let's do all sorts of things, we have to know not to play God at some point. So Yaakov represents the concept of religion and morality as a breaking mechanism to hold back society from going too far. So society has to go far. It has to go out and do things, not just sit in kolo. But the tzaddik who sits in kolo, in some indirect way, it's hard to know directly how that influence goes, kind of puts a limit, puts a break. You can go this far, but you don't go that far. But Rav Kook says, you need the Yaakovs of the world. Yeah. But if all Torah does is be a naysayer, if all Torah is doing is saying, no, 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 can't, that's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is where you take those very powers of creativity and innovation and you use them for Kedusha. So instead of looking at the world as, okay, the bad guys are doing all the creativity, but I got to let them do it because who else is going to do it? And I'm just going to hold them back. you reach another level of Yisrael where you triumph over that power and you use that power in good and productive ways. Rav Kook sees this as two different stages in the evolution of morality. Now, this may sound very abstract, and Rav Kook is very abstract, very poetic, so it's not necessarily, not necessarily something that people can grasp very easily. But just to give you an example of what he's talking about, let's say in the contemporary context. Typically, if you look at the Knesset, right? So we have religious parties in the Knesset. So typically what happens is the government proposes different things, and the Haredi parties are in the business of saying no. Can't do it, because this is against halacha. So they are fulfilling the Yaakov function, that society wants to do things, and those things might be connected to Torah. Actually, I'm judging them favorably, because some of the Haredi parties are just interested for money. But let's assume that they have good grounds. So they're being naysayers in a proper way, because when the government wants to do something that's against Yiddishkeit, so you have to have people that say no. So Rav Kook would call that the Yaakov in society. But here is the thing. You might look at a Haredi politician and you say, okay, you say what we're proposing is no good. What do you propose? How do you want to deal with the police department on Shabbos? How do you want to deal with healthcare? How do you want to deal with the environment? Give us a way that the Torah will enable these functions to be carried out. I think you'll find they often have no idea. Meaning to say, they know what to say no about, but there's no alternative. Meaning to say, what often happens is that we need the Chilonim and the Goyim and the Aaron, and we need them to do all this stuff because we have no idea how to do it within Halacha. So Rav Kook says that's intrinsically a chisarin. Because if the Torah is eternal, there must be ways within Hashem's Torah that all of these things can be done without by keeping Hashem's Torah. And that is what Rav Kook would call Yisrael. That is when you don't simply act as a naysayer on what society wants to do, but you take those very impulses and you find ways of using them within a framework of Kedusha. It's really quite an amazing thought. But again, it's a highly abstract idea. Yeah.
I heard Rabbi Tatz speaking about the idea of the generations being compared to different parts of the body, and he said, I think either our generation or the one that's lowest is the one of the hill.
Yes.
So I understand the analogy, except when it gets to the humility, as you say, because you said that the hill is also symbolic of humility, but it seems that the further we progress in time, actually it doesn't fit because we're becoming less and less humble.
No, that is correct, which is why we're truly the heel. We're truly the bottom because we lack even that humility. We're kind of the heel within the heel. You're correct. You're correct. But as I say, every anatomical representation has a positive aspect and a negative aspect, just like the old photographs. Although you may never have used a regular camera. Anyone knows what a regular, but the old cameras with film in the ancient world. So there used to be something called a photographic negative. Okay, so every picture has a negative that's the same thing, but kind of the colors are reversed. So the same thing, when you take a visual image of Akev, so the bad of the Akev is golos, inferiority, being in the mud, meshukab, chumriyot, but the good aspect is humility. So it's possible that at any given moment in time, you are being reflective of only the negative aspect and not the positive, or even vice versa. So that's why there can be contradictory imagery, like a positive and a negative, within a single snapshot. Okay, so basically, therefore, what we've given tonight is two different explanations for the Yaakov Yisrael. The first is that Yaakov is humility, Yisrael is triumph, and the reason both names are maintained is it is only through humility that one achieves triumph and victory over the adversity. And the second explanation is Rav Kook's idea that Yaakov represents restraining evil. Yisrael represents taming and controlling and channeling these impulses to live within boundaries of Kedusha. Okay? And that is why both names are maintained, as opposed to Avraham, where we only look at the universal mission. We no longer focus on the parochialism of Av Liarav. Yeah.
So why is it that Yeshivish society, Brady society, has rejected such works as Hilchos Adina by the Tzitzit Eliezer? Is it because Rav Kook is coming with the idea, or is it because they don't like the idea as an idea?
Yeah. Just to be sure everyone knows what we're referring to. In the early years of the State of Israel, the first chief rabbi of the Medina was Rav Yitzchak Herzog. Very, very interesting person, very hush of a person. Rav Herzog had been a rabbi in Ireland and then England, and then he came over. I think he was born in Dublin. In fact, his father was mayor of Dublin. He was an Orthodox Jew. His father was an Orthodox Jew, but he was like Lord Mayor of Dublin or something. But Rav Herzog came to Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Herzog had very much this idea that he wanted to create a state, a modern state, in which all of the necessary functions would be carried out, but you wouldn't have to need goyim or rely on people not keeping mitzvot. But he wanted to create the structure, at least. I mean, obviously, he wouldn't force anybody to be frum. That wasn't the issue. But he wanted to create a structure where all of the essential functions of a modern democratic state could be done within a halachic framework. So he commissioned different gedolim, different poskim, to write about different parts of society. So the project was never really completed because, number one, the secular Zionists weren't interested, and some of the right wing weren't interested either, so he didn't have a big constituency for this project. But one of the people who did rise to the challenge was the great Posek Rebbe Eliezer Waldenberg, who just died maybe 2 or 3 years ago in his 90s. But back in the early 50s, he wrote a 3-volume work called Hilchos Medina. This is in addition to his 22-volume work, Tzitz Eliezer of Shelos Tshuvas. But this was a separate work, Hilchos Medina, in which he goes through every type of thing a government does. Police department, fire department, army, navy, electricity, to try to show you halachically how all of these things could be done. Now, obviously, to some degree, a lot of it is out of date because the technologies are different. I mean, he was describing technology that existed in the 1950s. But the underlying concept was that the Torah must give us a way that we can do these things. And he went through the poskim, went through all the different shitas and the like. Now, Hilchos Medina was printed in the 50s. It was literally disappeared. It was totally out of print. It was you could not get it for around 50 years. Then they finally reprinted it after Rav Waldenberg was nifter, etc. And it was almost a suppressed work. And you are correct that many in the Torah world didn't like that project. Again, it's very, very tricky. Part of it was that since World War II, the overall philosophy of the Haredi world is that we try to put as many people in full-time learning as possible, and we don't want to talk about, how do you become a frum engineer? Because that might take somebody out of kollel. Now, why the Haredi world took that particular turn is a very, very interesting question. Many say it was a result of the Holocaust. And that is, the Holocaust destroyed 6 million Jews, but so many Talmidei Chachamim, so many yeshivos, so many people who were the great, great leaders of Am Yisrael, that there was a state of emergency where you just had to get everybody you could, to learn as much Torah as possible. Seen in this way, the emphasis that everybody should do full-time learning, some have suggested, was an abnormality. It was an abnormality in response to a tragic situation. And optimally, the pendulum should swing towards the middle, in which we would have, well, again, let me explain what I mean by the middle. Every single Jew must learn Torah every single day. That's the middle, okay? The middle, the idea of not learning, that's not the middle. That's off the edge, right? Okay? So when I talk about the middle, I'm not talking about not learning. I'm talking about, you know, serious learning every single day. But you would combine it with some type of profession, whether it be a business, whether it be medicine, engineering, whatever it would be. That was the norm. You had a certain segment who were the full-time Talmidei Chachamim, and then you had people who learned every day and learn every day, but were working. That was the norm, and some people have suggested that the Haredi changing of that norm was in response to a state of emergency. Now the question becomes, how long is a state of emergency supposed to exist? Once again, the Holocaust has now been around 70 years. So people are talking about this. Again, people are talking about this. Rav Steinman, even Rav Shach, before Rav Shach was Nifter, you will know that in the Haredi world, there is now Parnassa schools, not college. College is a separate issue because of the tznias and everything else. But they're creating trade schools for Haredim to teach computers or whatever it is, appliance repair. You can make a good living, by the way. If you're looking for a good job in Israel, look into heating and air conditioning repair. Very good job. I know a fellow who is a professor of physics in Cambridge, very prestigious academic appointment. And he made Aliyah, and now he fixes air conditioning. I mean, he was a full professor in Cambridge. He says, you know, someone I once asked him, do you feel like, you know, you've taken a demotion? He says, I don't know, I'm making a lot more money. He says. So he feels fine about that. And Baruch Hashem, he's doing a big chesed. When you're cold or you're hot, he's helping, you know, he's Yishev Eretz Yisrael. It's a great mitzvah. So that's why people are talking about bringing it back into the middle. Okay, that's really my short answer. My short answer is that the Holocaust distorted many, many things, and it required that we take maybe a more extreme view than would have been the norm within Am Yisrael. Because people make mistakes. I mean, people sometimes think, oh, in the golden age of Europe, you know, everybody was learning all day. I mean, the MS is only a very small percentage of people were in the great yeshivas in Europe. The average European Jew, from Jew, went to work at 15. You know, but Baruch Hashem, the environment was such that everybody learned. And not everybody learned advanced Gemara. Some people learned Chumash. Some people went to an Ein Yaakov Shir, an Agadata, and the like. So the notion that everybody who can stays in full-time learning, that was absolutely not the case in Europe, and that's a post-Holocaust phenomenon based on a state of emergency. But that doesn't mean it wasn't justifiable. It very well could have been justifiable because there was such a need. The question is that kind of the permanent modality of Am Yisrael? A very difficult question. It's a very difficult question. I'm not here to give you an answer to that. It's something a person has to grapple with. But that is maybe why the Hilchos Medina became consigned to oblivion as a result. Okay, all right, well, we'll stop here. Y'all have a good day, Travis.